A prominent New Yorker just back from Haiti fears that the relief effort there may fail. He is Charles King, the CEO of Housing Works. You may know Housing Works here in New York, the country's largest community-based AIDS organization that deals with housing. Since 1990, they provided housing, medical care, meals, and job training to more than 20,000 homeless or low-income New Yorkers living with HIV or AIDS. You may not know that they've also been working with AIDS organizations in Haiti and are currently setting up AIDS clinics there to replace those destroyed in the January 12th earthquake. Housing Works CEO Charles King joins me now, along with Dr. Vati Poitevin. She is the medical director of Housing Works 13th Street Health Center in the West Village. She is of Haitian birth and lost her parents, both parents, in the earthquake. They've just both returned from Haiti. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi.
Thank you.
And Dr. Poitevin, I am so sorry for your loss. First of all, what you do usually here in New York and what you've been doing since the quake.
I'm an infectious disease physician, HIV specialist, and I am the medical director, as you said before, of the 13th Street location. And I'm also the primary provider there. So we see HIV patients on a day-to-day basis. I also do education groups at 13th Street.
And what have you been doing in Haiti? You just got back.
Yes,
right?
We went back, and what we did is that, first of all, we went through DR, the Dominican Republic, which is the best way to go there, bought supplies, crossed quite easily the border, and went to Haiti with supplies, medical supplies that we got from here. And we were able, actually, in quite quick time, with some difficulty, but we were able to get clinics that had been functioning before but were damaged, set up tents in their backyards and start seeing patients. Actually, we were able to see the patients on that Sunday. My husband, who was orthopedic surgery trained, was able to do some bone setting.
So about 5 days after
the quake. 5 days after the quake, yep.
And Charles King, you've been blogging your experience, and your most recent post was troubling. It was titled, "Why Healthcare Relief May Fail in Haiti." Why might it?
Well, right now there's a whole bunch of folk engaged in all kinds of disparate relief efforts, but without any overall organization, much less ties to the local community. We've had a number of encounters, first of all, where we've witnessed what I can only describe as cowboy doctoring, folk riding around, not even speaking the language, trying to treat people and doing so inadequately, something that we would consider plain out malpractice. And then a lot of medical staff going down there without any real destination, sitting at the airport, going home frustrated, going to the central hospital, which doesn't need any more medical personnel, afraid to get out into the community. So I'm afraid all too many people are going down there to feed their own egos on sort of a disaster junket instead of really figuring out a systematic way to get involved with the local community and do what they need to have happen, not what makes us feel good.
Dr. Poitevin, is that a little harsh on your fellow medical professionals who are, after all, going into this disaster zone?
I know Charles, there is a certain frustration. When we were there Sunday, doctors have been there. Where we went and we were able to help, there was a team of doctors who went there, but they didn't speak the language, so they could not communicate, and they actually didn't know what to do. So what Charles says is that a lot of the time, from what I've seen, people are neglecting the Haitian population. And even though we're not entirely victims, when you go to neighborhoods, there is organization. They need to involve the Haitians in this. And that's what we've done. We have 4 Haitian nurses. We have 2 Haitian doctors. If you don't have the buy-in of the population, they're running on aimlessly in the streets without being able to do anything good.
And we can open up the phones for a few minutes, I think, for Haitian New Yorkers, in this case, to talk about what you're hearing from home at this point is the relief effort being done in the optimal possible way? It is, after all, a chaotic emergency situation, unprecedented, really, in anybody's experience, this kind of thing. So what are you hearing from Haiti, if you're a Haitian New Yorker, about how the relief effort is done? How could they do it better? Our guests are involved in it and obviously want to help and have thoughts about the organization of the thing and not just the patient-by-patient experience. So 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Charles King, CEO of Housing Works, and Vati Poitevien, Dr. Poitevien, who is the medical director of the 13th Street Clinic in the West Village for Housing Works. Doctor, what are the particular challenges in serving this vulnerable population during an all-out crisis? You're Haitian. You went to medical school in Haiti. Mm-hmm. give us some background on the Haitian experience of the AIDS epidemic and how that plays into the current crisis.
That's a question. Well, as we know, when we started talking about AIDS in Haiti in the 70s, it started with such a stigma. You know, the 4-H, Haitian were considered an isolated risk factor. That stigma that was across the world was also in Haiti.
So the 4-H, let me just, for people who don't know that reference, and people who've been around long enough do remember the beginning of the mm-hmm. AIDS epidemic, late 70s, early 80s, and public health officials identified four what they thought were independent risk groups, all of which happened to start with H: homosexuals, hemophiliacs because they were getting blood transfusions, heroin users because they were using dirty needles, and being of Haitian origin.
Yes.
And that was the only one that didn't reflect some kind of risky behavior.
Yes, it was a nation. So a nation was stigmatized. Now, when you look back 30 years later, that stigma is still there. It's not across the board, but in Haiti, being HIV positive, he's a very shameful position to be.
Public health officials did remove
Haitians
from the list and apologize.
Yes.
Just to be clear.
Yes, we sure did. But, you know, the damage, unfortunately, was tremendous. And I often compare the health situation in Haiti. I said it's like someone who had terminal cancer and has now a car accident. So now we have the trauma, but the trauma is on top of a sick situation. People with HIV in Haiti were underserved before this. And as Haitian are in general, and that's the idea behind our centers reaching out to HIV positive, because what we fear is that in view of their stigma, they'll stay home, they'll stay back, because they know that their clinic has been toppled and they won't reach doctors.
So, Charles King, I gather you're opening three health clinics in Haiti, two HIV clinics in one in Port-au-Prince, one north of the city, a third one to serve Haitian families in a neighborhood of Port-au-Prince where thousands of poor families are camping out.
Yes, yes. So I want to be clear that we didn't just go in on our own.
Yes.
We've been working for 2 years now with a coalition of AIDS organizations headed up by people living with AIDS and HIV, VAPLUS. The day after the earthquake, we started receiving emails from some of the leadership of FAPLIS begging us to come in with whatever relief we could. As Vati described, we flew down on Friday, carried in $40,000 worth of supplies. On Sunday morning, we're able to hold a meeting with the available leadership of FAPLUS, and their request to us was to help them open an AIDS clinic. They actually took me to see the single largest HIV/AIDS clinic in Port-au-Prince, which had been completely pancaked, which meant that every single staff person who was inside, as well as every patient, had died. And
my
so
God.
That set us out on our way.
My God, my God. So give us a sense of the process of setting up these clinics. in the midst of a major relief effort. How do you get a structurally sound building up in no time and with aftershocks still going on? How do you get medical supplies?
So we brought in the initial supplies. We've been working in partnership with Aid for AIDS here in New York, who's been collecting particularly HIV but other medical supplies and packaging them to ship down. One of the member organizations of FAPLIS offered us their yard. It's not a structurally sound building, but we do have the front yard, and so we set up TARP examining rooms, a TARP waiting room. There was a building out back that we could use for storing food and other supplies. At the family clinic, there was a tiny boutique in front of the clinic that was still sound, and so we were able to get that space cleaned out, and just yesterday put a nurse and doctor in that clinic. They saw 50 patients.
So in the midst of trying to set up your clinics, you met a Haitian man who had applied to Canadian visas for his family, his wife, his three kids. They have relatives in Canada, but they believe that because his wife is HIV positive, they were denied visas. And you wrote on your blog that you made a note of it to see if you could get your Canadian friends to raise hell and get pro bono legal help. Is this a common issue for HIV-positive people coming from Haiti?
I was actually shocked by this experience. Just last summer, we actually used the Canadian policies to shame the United States government around our then ban on people with HIV coming into the country. I became aware of it because I was chairing a conference that had 150 Canadians with HIV coming to the United States, and most of them were unable to make it. So it was just astounding to me that while Canadians ostensibly don't have a ban, they were using the notion of burden on the public purse as a preclusion. The good news is that I immediately sent an email out to friends, and we now have one of the top immigration attorneys in Canada who's taken the case on a pro bono basis.
Fatih Poitevin and Charles King from the New York AIDS organization Housing Works, now also doing work in Haiti. And Dr. Poitevin, do you think that with so many people homeless now in Haiti that there needs to be more of a public discussion about refugee status here and in Canada and in other countries?
Certainly, yes, but I don't want that discussion to overshadow what we can do for Haiti in Haiti. I think a lot of people don't want to leave. Some people want to leave, but a lot of people don't want to leave. And I think the reconstruction, but a reconstruction with Haiti, with Haitian, and this is, I'm going to put a call out to the Haitian diaspora. This is a time for us to make a decision, either turn our back on Haiti, and if you want to turn your back on your country, it's totally fine because it brought a lot of suffering to all of us, or involve ourselves. There are a lot of professionals who actually were trained in Haiti, like me. So it's a time for us to raise our voices.
What are you asking your fellow members of the diaspora to do?
To raise our voices and get ourselves involved 100%. You know, what meetings are happening about Haiti, that we're talking about helping Haiti, but the voices of Haitians are very far and dimmed.
Raise voices for refugee status or to gather more supplies? What?
To coordinate the help that we're getting. At this point, I think the help is there. There is a commitment, either short-term or long-term. That's what needs to be decided. But we need to raise our voices and inform that commitment.
There are people currently camping out all over Port-au-Prince. Are there refugee camps that you saw springing up in or outside the city or even in the Dominican Republic?
In the city, there are refugee camps. They are self-sprung, made by people. There is no organized refugee camp as to these days, you know, the biggest camp. This morning on NPR, they were naming the camps, and they're, you know, Saint-Louis Gonzague, that's a school, Saint-Pierre, that's the square in Pétionville. This is, the people are doing it on their own without any, you know, any organized status.
So, Charles, are people afraid that the refugee camps might become permanent settlements like they have in so many other war zones or disaster zones around the world?
I think from what I've been hearing on the ground, right now people haven't even had the opportunity to think that far. The vast majority, when we talk about camps, we're not talking about any kind of organized structure with real delivery of tents. We're talking about people hanging sheets off of anything they can to cover themselves. I got an email just last week when I was back here between trips, and the email said, "Oh my God, it started to rain." And it was only a small shower, but when you think of millions of people out in the street with mm-hmm. absolutely nothing to cover themselves, even a small rain is a potential recipe for disaster. Yes.
So a refugee camp, in the sense that we usually think of it, with tents would actually be an improvement.
Certainly. And yesterday, Dr. Farmer was saying that now the need for tents.
On this show.
Exactly. Yes.
Paul Farmer from Partners in Health. So I'm going to change up the topic for our last few minutes since Housing Works Clinic is on West 13th Street in the Village. There is, of course, the news today that Continuum Health Partners, New York City's largest hospital system, might take over St. Vincent's Hospital and turn it into an outpatient center. Doctor, do you have any reaction to that as far as the impact that that would have on the neighborhood, HIV patients and others?
Oh, tremendous. We use St. Vincent as a referral hospital. This is where we send patients that, you know, need to be admitted. And this is the closest emergency room that we have. That would be tremendous for the community. It leaves us with a big void. I hope that's not final.
Charles King?
I would certainly endorse what Dr. Portavin has just said. We definitely need an emergency room and an inpatient hospital in the lower west part of Manhattan. It's essential, and it's insane that we're even having this kind of discussion.
What would happen without it?
Well, when you're talking about emergency, there is the time is of the essence. So you definitely people will tell you there is something, but it's those 2, 3, 4 minutes in New York traffic can mean life or death for our patients.
Which means crosstown on 14th Street to Beth Israel, or all the way up to 59th Street on the west side.
The CEO of Housing Works, Charles King. Also, Dr. Vwati Poitavian, she's the medical director of Housing Works 13th Street Health Center in the West Village. They are also both now doing work in Haiti. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Quick reminder that during the State of the Union address tonight, I'll be hosting an online chat at WNYC.org, our website. So if you want to hang out online with other Brian Lehrer Show listeners while you're watching the speech, come on in. Also joining us will be Pat Morrison, who hosts a similar show on the Los Angeles Public Radio Station, and many of her listeners as well. So it should be big bicoastal fun during the State of the Union Address tonight. That's our online chat during the State of the Union Address tonight at 9 on our website at WNYC.org. And the Brian Lehrer Show continues in a minute.